I thought he was in this or we'll just take off the camera. What are you doing? I haven't seen her for a while though. This is just the verse from a track I have. It's called Hope, right? But there's actually three of us on the track, but I don't have the other two lads with me tonight, right? So I'll just show you one of the verses from it anyway. 1, 2, 3, 4. Waking up again, life is tough again, feeling rough again. Sick of doing the same thing, so you're juggling 101 things at one time. Dying inside, but you said that you feel fine. Behind us all is the past, don't let it hold you back. Hope and faith will keep us going in the present past. So to the future we must look instead. It's kind of like a book that's unread that you must write yourself. To people in prisons, I pray that you can find a way, or you can open your mind and you can find a way. And to the people on the streets, I just want you to know that anyone can fall off, so don't be left in the cold. Everybody, I know that it's hard, seems like a joke at times as we approach certain parts, but in the heart of a soldier is a fighter, and that's something to know. So don't give up, because it's hope that keeps us going.
Thanks, Anthony. Right. Next up we have Shane Harrington.
But the end of it goes, you darken the story again, and bring my own heckler and crush. Windmills. 2 dozen strong, they glide our way. 2,000 feet, we dare not stall. Our thermals yet have further sway. 2 dozen strong, they still sashay. With onshore breeze, they face the bay. We tilt beyond their beck and call. 2 dozen strong, they glide away. 2,000 feet, too swift to stall. Again and again, faint but clear as the luminous frost, clear as the starry heavens, the message repeated in hope. Repeated in hope, repeated in hope, message repeated in hope. Much, much too late for too many, yet due to Morse code, hundreds of souls are plucked from the icy brink. From the icy brink, from the icy brink, plucked from the icy brink. Again, Marconi's newfangled device responds in disbelief to the rescue, in disbelief to the rescue, in disbelief to the rescue, responds in disbelief to the rescue. But wireless history was made and quickly forgot for saving that small ship, SS Minnehaha. Ben Garrett. Secret Paul Gorham, fading astern, our muted oars can drown the stream's gurgle. See that mackerel sky as we meet the open basin. Ahead breaks the surface, bulbous and slick, bristling of whiskers and snares in the moonlight. A bark to starboard, an answer, a beam, splash astern, grunt abreast, colony line on adjacent sea rock. In this school we pause, immersed in aquatics, eavesdropping. Smoothly our miles to our mooring, we all know well the sacrilegious outboard must remain tilted and still. And I finish with this one. Gregory O'Donoghue told me a long time ago, it's very difficult to write about writing. But this is writing about not writing, so sorry. Writer's block. First aimed to carve a canto, to date not one short motto. An outline dot I've yet to spot, my royalties not 1 euro. This crack is overrated, this pad is mostly suited to coffee stains and paper planes and writers ill assorted. That summer in Sorrento, I saw the great Caruso. Without his coat, he held a note and reached a great crescendo. Last month I had my finest hour, refilled my pen with great rapport, and got the gist, the shopping list, it dawned on me at 4:30. Still draped inside the window, I hear my novel Seiko, air freshener stink, how can I think, she's full of my own shadow. You're due an explanation, my lack of elocution, I'll sound the lexic gully traps for just the right inflection. I often get a notion of skill to craft inscription, compose a line and call it mine, I've yet to reach a caption. No counting on Nintendo, IQ square root of zero, out of words and for the birds, I never like the spiral. Resorting to transcription, an Arabic concoction, the canon still a greasy till, I dread the next edition. I'm lounging on my lilo, I doodle one more limo, I never hit a spark of wit, I need a new magneto. I stop inside my dungeon, fail to write a smidgen, deep and hock against the clock, a blot on the escutcheon. No brain dead as dodo, you can take it as de facto, I am to blame to name and shame, excuse the innuendo.
That's not drowned from the bar there, I do believe, unless there's an accessory problem. And next up to the open mic, Jennifer Matthews.
I was just having a really nice conversation there about how visual art can inspire poetry, and here's an attempt I made. I used to think Andy Warhol was a bit of an airhead until I saw a great exhibit that kind of showed what he really can do. And in the series, he takes photographs from the news, and turn them into one of his art pieces where he repeats the image, the photograph from a newspaper over and over. This one in particular was a car crash that was very, very gruesome, so maybe the poem will tell you about that. It's called After Green Car Crash by Andy Warhol. Instantly crucified for my hit-and-run crime, my body flung itself anti-clockwise from the inferno, pinned me to this electrical pole. Now I wait, looking down at reporters taking details for the dinners, and at the sinners silently confessing their crimes, while horrified at mine, I hang here, with a spike through my chest, like a painting above a sofa, not dead yet. Now the artist comes for me, on repeat, eternally. He screens my tragedy over and over, an orgy of ink-lapping boundaries. Then he washes the scene in a reassuring, sea on green, like the dollar is being waved for me. When I look past Warhol, I can see all of New York from here, auctioning my carnage, which is dripping down and burning up the walls of Christie's. But the biggest crime here is the man of my time, walking under my body for posterity, pretending he's not a witness. Fight my deathless, breathless choking at the scavengers below. Burn this painting. Stop your rubbernecking. You will have your 15 too. Poor guy in the photograph, like he was literally hanging on a pole, still alive when the photograph was being taken, while all these people are just kind of doing the business below. And they just saw it. But interestingly, he had hit somebody and sped away, and that's why he had the crash in the first place, is because he hit somebody else. It was, I'm going to stop the question. Okay. In interest of time, I've got just one more. This is one from the news years and years ago, about 5 years ago, where apparently American soldiers were protecting this empty palace for no apparent reason, when in a separate incident, a curator of an ancient museum in the Middle East was boarding up his own museum because looters were on the way and he wanted to protect the antiquities who were there. So I thought that was an interesting contrast. Okay, one, the curator's jacket lays in sand that shifts over darker depths of fermenting currency. The man pauses with trowel in hand, bricks now weighed high over the museum door. He considered how many graves there are here, and how many scavengers are lifting their noses to the wind on the horizon. Two. Just beyond, a soldier sits alone in the wide windows of a new palace. A machine gun rests across his lap, a scepter to a figurehead, protecting broken glass on beautifully tiled floors. Three. Continents away, I make my pilgrimage to the Rosetta Stone, longing to reach through the glass, and leave my prints on the hieroglyphs, run my nails along the demotic scratches, and pull off clumps of Greek to put into my pockets, lodestones for important work. Thanks.
Thank you, Jen. And now, by special appearance, on the occasion of his 70th birthday, the Hector Laureate, of course, Jerry Murphy.
Hey,
I win.
It's
just take up on Jennifer's first poem about the crash. It's called Free Kick. That boy racer who sped through the traffic lights of the pedestrian crossing and gave the finger to a few girls protest has just slammed into a lawnmower 50 metres further up the road. His severed head is rolling down the slight incline and will soon come to a halt within reach of your right boot. Since it is my 70th birthday, this is called In the Retirement Home. And Ben is just getting ready for it.
You're not a day over zero.
In the retirement home, Neil Armstrong leans back in his rocker and points at the moon. "I've been there," he declares. "Of course you have, you hired a nurse." I'm going to finish with a short poem. It's called, It's called The Anxiety of Influence after Harold Bloom. You've all read the book, of course. That's what you have. Anyway, The Anxiety of Influence.
Thanks, Jerry. And next up, could we please have Anita Davey?
This is about a weekend, a holiday that I spent with my aunt. I often go to spend the weekend with her. And this is thanks to her for the holiday. More than a holiday, you, the teacher by profession, dignified, a role model for all those years of children's classes that have passed through your heart. Whenever we meet, Anita, you say, and spread your arms out wide for a hug in elegant joy. Eat tiny meals and at celebrations, huge amounts of vegetables and fruit. For special occasions, you will be wearing African clothing, floral patterns, a flowing shape, in memory of when you taught there. Pedal down hills and bikes of 65. Go for a run first in the morning on only an orange. Swim and walk all summer long. Lately you move into feeding others, and now they come to you as a home with us.
Thanks, Anita. Next up, we have Eugene Crowley.
Slow is conversation, slow is slow, in the arms of Marcia. Two glasses and slang with Sylvie. Beer or vinegar, she knew.
Beer for me, please. Next up to the mic, Rosie O'Regan.
This is called Dare to Dance.
What becomes of the broken-hearted in a heartless world, where pain is peddled and dreams burned for plastic pearls and everyone yearns for the grass on the other side, though it's not green enough? Where Big Brother's mother bakes cakes laced with losing, takes choice from choosing, scatters seeds on concrete and feeds gold to gold, selling everything sold and bruising. What must we become to overcome our fear of feeling the harm we have done, to realize we are not rats racing or parts for placing in the monetary machine, that ignorance is not bliss, and a kiss cannot soothe our sorrow. Tomorrow is for the asking, and there is no good masking our eyes. We cannot disguise ourselves from ourselves. We can all delve deeper, find the earth beneath our feet, our destiny's keeper. So dare to dance on the edge of a chance, and let the questions go, and breathe the breath of your rhythmic step. Sing your unsung song, its melody and tone. Could you jump through the loop and shoot the hoops for the safety Satan? Could you? Would you? Dare to dance on the edge of a chance. Thank you.
Rosie, and next up we have Christy Parker.
Oh, thank you. I haven't been sleeping too well the last couple of nights, so now I'm really sure I'm going to actually have a couple of weeks because I'm very much aware. I'm sure you all are, I mean, pretty good off the Eurovision podcast. I mean, the true best memories of what we have from the Eurovision podcast, I guess, nothing anyway, is of course Donna winning it for the first time and the only time. And the scary crowd from Finland who won it that time. Then it's more scary, but that was.
You can be sure.
But having watched those guys from Finland, when I kind of got an idea that I might actually be in support of myself, I'm still waiting for my letter to be replied to, but in the meantime, I have the song here. Father, what a win! I've got a Dracula mask left over from Halloween, and a lot of tomato ketchup and a white shirt. I've got gloves with studs and Wellingtons with dung, and I have a pair of leather trousers so tight they're hot, but I don't care because I want to look my best. And I know next year I'll win the Eurovision Song Contest. I'm going to have my face pierced with 35 safety pins, and a dying tattooist has agreed to do my teeth before he goes. The Undertaker says he will embalm me temporarily, so I'm guaranteed to shine, I suppose. But my integrity will be preserved for the duration of the test, while I'm in Hell's Kitchen winning the Eurovision Song Contest. I'm going to stuff my ears with fireworks wrapped in tinfoil, and add hair extensions to my nostrils, dyed green and gold. I'll trail a vote for a scary smile from a candidate politician from 2007, and wear Don Corleone-style boots. That's the men's box, I'm told. My vice and steel guitar, after a while, I will do the rest, as my feet stay firmly on the ground when I win the Eurovision Song Contest. And I'll be singing, very, very loud, very, very loud, because the backing boys will be going out with a hammer in tongs, on bass, pneumatic drill, a man called Satan, and on eardrums, Mr. Lucifer, who also plays a mean set of bongs. Our song will be called Nobody Survives This Fest. We're called Demented Dana, and expect all kinds of everything when we win next year's Eurovision Song Contest. Julie's just moving on very swiftly. I'm going to keep it gothic, and I can't tell you what this poem is about in advance, because if I do, I'll spy in the middle of it, not to mention the ending. It's called Oh Holy God. I'm not a man who is normally, by the way, just think of Good Friday when I'm listening to this, we pub. Oh Holy God, I'm not a man who is normally squeamish, but one night in a pub while sipping my beamish, I saw me standing beside me, the strangest of guys, with a very long stare and tattoos. A scar on his head split his hair down the middle, and the studs on his tongue seemed to hurt him a little. It looked like a rat had been chewing on one ear, and the fleas in his beard were not shy to appear. Black holes mocked his teeth, and I feared for the worst as the boils on his neck looked ready to burst. His arms were encircled with coils of barbed wire, and to judge by his trousers, he had been in a fire. 10 wasps caught the light as they glowed on his chin, and his knuckles and nose were stripped of their skin. His breath stank of cigarettes, whiskey, and doubt, and three blue butterflies were encircling his nose. I soon caught his eye and I said, pardon my staring, am I right to assume you drive for Pothern? He looked quite appalled and exclaimed, oh God, no. In fact, I'm quite helpful. My name's Father Joe. I knew his vocations weren't going too well, but surely I thought of not recruiting from hell. Rome was in trouble if it now came to pass that this man beside me could stay a Sunday mass. He said, I know you're in shock for my collar is missing, but I'm a gospel in flesh if you hang on and listen. The tattoos on my lids are the shape of the cross, but my eyes are not far from God, who's my boss. The scar on my head came from being baptized, the priest went on the font and the whole fucking teacher side. The stones on my tongue are like lies that are followed, but lies won't cause harm unless they are followed. The large piece that is missing from the top of my ear says we cannot believe half what we hear. And the 12 lively sleeves that play by my chin are the dozen apostles jumping out of their skin. Man will the case, says my black teeth, but then, happily by boils, they will rise again. The barbed wire on my arms keeps my clock safe and well, and the burns on my trousers remind us of hell. The commandments are seen through 12 watts on my jaw, and fighting the devil has my knuckles turned raw. The three stinks on my breath are the three wise men, the three men so wise, and the Trinity is there in those friendly blue flies. I bought him a pint and quickly confessed that living his faith had me very impressed. But was the church not upset, or had it not realized that he didn't wear black to be recognized? Oh, the church doesn't mind, he said with a wink, about what I do or even how much I drink. I'm free to be me and to save souls this way.
Thanks, Christy. Next up we have Joe Sweeney.
Hello there. This is the next page in a story, a ghost story that I'm writing about two boys whose parents have been killed in a car crash in the Catholic state of their Aunt Emily. It's called Aunt Emily's Secret. And it's the part where he just remembers some times back in the house that they've just left. It's called Memories. As the train pulls out, memories flood in. I find myself drifting back to the house in Appleton Road, to a September years ago. The dead chestnut leaves crackled under our feet as we rummaged around for bright shiny concrete. It is a Saturday. We've tied a thick rope from the branches of the old chestnut trees, and they're swinging from them wildly back and forth like there is no tomorrow. I am pushing Darren, and he's flying higher each time towards the sky. I hear Mrs. Gosling's kitten calling plaintively from one of the topmost branches of the tree. An hour later, she is still there. Kitty Coots, come on, Kitty Coots, I call. Her soft belly nestles gracefully down onto my upstretched arm as I climb carefully back down, holding her to my chest. I lift her like a trophy over my head and parade past Darren to present Kitty Coots to Mrs. Gosling, who has been leaning over the hedge with an anxious expression on her face, but now shows only relief. Darren, although terrified of heights, is anxious to show me he is not afraid. He can do anything I can do, so Puppy scrambles and promptly gets stranded like Mrs. Gosling's kitten. I tell him to come down, taunt him, tell him not to be a coward, but he remains up there, petrified, white-faced. I keep teasing and calling him frightened little kitten. My teasing finally succeeds, and he begins to move nervously, his arms and legs trembling as he moves from one branch to another. But so anxious is he to prove he is not afraid, he misses one of the branches and falls to the ground. He lies there, dazed, motionless. Darren? Darren? I'm suddenly terribly frightened. I panic, thinking he may be dead. I run towards the house calling for Mam. When I hear laughter and looking around, see Darren sitting up with his eyes wide open, pointing at me mockingly, ha ha ha. I should have been really angry with him, but I was so relieved I couldn't be and just chased him around the garden with a stick. I was only pretending he calls back to me as I hold the stick over him about to hit him. He screams. I throw the stick on the grass. I was only pretending too, I say. Oh, the times we had in that great old garden. It was a garden for all seasons. We used to invite friends around for our birthday parties during the summer. Every December, I would help Dad attach the Christmas lights to the branches of the chestnut trees outside. We used to place a wooden crib and a fork in the trunk. And on Christmas Eve, the whole cul-de-sac twinkled with our trees. And for those 2 weeks before Christmas, we were already in a kind of heaven. We would look forward to the dusk so we could turn on the lights. We loved to see the branches, especially the dead ones, coming alive and swaying in the wind like the spark of tentacles when after us. In the summer, we used to put up tents and sleep out all night in the garden. I can still remember the sound of the wood pigeons in the dark, leafy centre. All those long summer evenings when we'd football matches with the other boys and on the street, we thought they would go on forever. And that autumn, after a month back in school, I remember we had one of our secret meetings in the woodshed. It was here that we planned our traditional autumn raid on old Clark's orchard, which lies behind the high wall at the back of our garden. Clark is a big barrel of a man, a bachelor, who lived in England for years and speaks with an English accent. Mam said he is Irish, but we've never been sure. He has thick sideburns, he's furry as a badger and red cheeks. After a long time, during which we kept daring each other to boost our confidence, we finally decided to do the orchard one night. I got the shortest match and had to go first. The others gave me a bunt over the wall and I fell down on the ground on the other side, where I lay winded for a while listening to see if Clark noticed anything. The others, seeing I was all right, decided to come over as well then, and I remember how we nearly died laughing as we lay on our backs in the long grass, suddenly finding ourselves looking up into heaven full of red apples and stars. When we started messing around laughing and throwing apples at each other, we heard the bolts on the doors rattling, and then we saw Badger Clark's figure against the hall light as he stood at the door, shaking his walking stick at us. "Why couldn't you ask if you wanted an apple, you little brat?" he bellowed at us, his face trembling, and we all made a rush for the wall. Looking around, I felt suddenly sorry for old Clark. "Sorry," I shouted ridiculously as we scrambled back up the wall, laughing and falling over each other in our haste. "Well, I'm sorry now. Sorry for everything. Sorry for myself and Darren." How quickly life can change. 1 minute you're walking down the street with your hands in your pockets whistling, your life firmly in place, and the next minute you're kneeling down trying to gather broken pieces to put things back together the way they were or can never be again. Thank you very much.
Next up, we haven't seen him in ages, all the way from Ballycarter, the muttering poet, Louis Mulcahy.
This is based on the rules of speech to Cassius in the Jerusalem, the tide of the affairs of men. How brief our stay, now on the edge of turning, this has been long filling, stealing over sand made hot by day-long sun. In the evening warmth I bathe, before the swell pulls back to where dark beds hold rest. Intimation. In the long, low sun shadow of the coming car, a crow swooped, skimming from the road the dry remains of a squashed corpse, and in screwing crash plane rise, cleared the hedge and lost flight gliding. And that in Irish is lost. Corha, his forefather, on chor in an aig, hurling on an oak con corp lorac, a valad the moher. I was a screw all treed air, and he is is there agent or crest that shall fall, sort of head that I cut, like his holy shame was a queer woman. And this one, I wrote this for Patrick's Day, but I haven't read it for you. Patrick, did you bring soup the second time, or just your bent head stick and Roman creed? Did they call your holy servant to peel for your return? Did faithful followers chant amen to impiety within your call? Did you fight with paschal fire the druids you would supplant? Was your ad's head tried by gifts from would-be nuns, unread, uneducated, without command of language, but well versed in protocol, you proselytized and self-declared self-doubt? Yet how effective your throne shaped, as you got rid of snakes that never were, and like those who came before, made your overtures to women who might sway. Mayron Sukhat, may we call you Patrick, did you meet Palladius, who left the ground rough broken round the mounds of Dorban water? O Patricia, stairway of the demons across the Shamrock Harpent font, did they find your fasting fascinating like the candles of the monk? Or did you, like the Dalai Lama, through gentle wandering wonder, charm all to your breast? Thank you.